Bokeh tov, Charlie. Good to see you. Yaakov, Jack, I got your phone call with the comments. As far as taking on the Chiloni world, I'll leave it to a version of Rakefet 40 years younger. If I could go back in time when I was in the army and say that at my age, halavai, I should just take care of my own surroundings. But the challenge, the younger people have to take over. That's why Rabbi Grinstein is alive and kicking. He has a task to do. But what has to be shown to them is continuity, why we're here. The best story is right after the Yom Kippur War, there was an officer who was one of the liaisons between Israel and Egypt, and Benny Gal. And they became friendly. The Egyptian officer said to him, "Why are you in Israel? Why does this land belong to you?" So Benny Gal says, "Well, I'm Jewish." And the Egyptian officer says, "You're Jewish. You're Mechalel Shabbos. You're Ochlin Avechim Treifat. You don't observe anything. P.S. If you saw Benny Gal today, he's a Jew with a long beard and a long history of what he accomplished in advertising in the Torah community." And it all began. It's a legendary story. He told it many times on TV, on radio. It all began because that Egyptian officer said, "You're Jewish? What do you mean you're Jewish?" All right, we can begin. First of all, I want to thank...
Okay, let me start the recording if you're ready.
Right, right.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay,
good. I want to thank Professor Tarragon. I want to thank Yomo because you have no idea how I'm sitting here. I wish you could see the sight. Why you just spent the fortune. I'm totally closed in by a plastic wall. You don't see it because the camera's in front of it, but I have more room on the desk today. It's a little bit easier. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, I'm giving a special on Reb Adin Steinsaltz Zitzal. I spoke in class, but this will be a larger elaboration. They gave me a half hour. Halavai, I should finish in a half hour. But we'll do what we can. Lefa'er ulahaded zichrono hanifla. Today is Monday, September 7th, 2020. And we're picking up where we left off. There's no question that there was a... Oh, I want to make one correction. I mentioned about the book from Torah Vadas last week and how they, again, Art Scroll, and it hurts me. I don't even want to talk about it. But they totally rewrite Torah history, leaving out all that Eitz Chaim and Rabbi Revel did, Lachatchila. So in the new Torah Vadas, beautiful coffee table book, the first picture having anything to do, I think I said in class it's on 265, it's on 245. 245. So if anyone has access to it, look at that picture and you'll see the Ribbono Shel Olam slapping their face for not mentioning the good of YU. And when you see that picture, you'll understand what I'm referring to. Now, there's no question the world changes. Every last one of us has been affected by it. The refugees poured into America. I grew up, as I told you, I went to school. I'm not a Holocaust survivor, but believe me, I consider myself a Holocaust survivor. All my classmates either ran before or ran during or survived, went through hell. One of my closest friends was Abba Brandspiegel. I need not elaborate. And it changed. America changed. The Litvakin poured in, the Hasidim poured in, and while many lost their faith in the Holocaust, there are no two ways about it. Facts are facts. But nevertheless, many regained their faith, many lost it, many intensified, and they made up their mind, as the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe said, Amerikas nishtanderish, it's not going to be any different here. Now, I just want to deal with one question that came my way, which is an important question. Until today, we speak of the Litvakim, we speak of the Hasidim. What happened to the Yekkes? Germans came, Washington Heights, we spoke about it, Rabbi Breuer, I've given so many lectures. The Rav speaks about it. I quote him word by word. I consider those essays that I translated from Yiddish into English and I published in volume 2 of my work on my Rebbe, I consider that one of my most important contributions to Torah history, to Torah scholarship. And the Rav, where am I different than Rav Hirsch? I mean, that's precious. It's not Rakefet speaking, it's not a lightweight. This is Mori Urebi, Moreinu V'Rabbeinu, the Rav, asking the very question, where am I different? And the truth of the matter is, number one, statistically, you're talking in terms of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Litvakin, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Chassidim. I would say with Washington Heights and Charlie, you can correct me, but overall, if I say 10,000 religious Germans poured in, am I overstating the case or am I about right? What do you say, Charlie? 10,000. I can't. I'm not making out your answer, but I'm not too far off, will you agree? 10,000 is a round figure, not too far off. Now, the Germans voted themselves out of business because what happened was very simple. In America, you have to make choices. It's no longer Frankfurt, it's no longer Berlin, it's no longer the Alte Heim, the old country. And the community basically split over the decades. A good deal of German Orthodoxy moved into the Lakewood syndrome. You'll find in Lakewood and Lakewood branches all over the United States, good German names, grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Torah and Derech Eretz people. There's been some real machloket in public. I don't want to go into it now. We spoke about it years ago when it happened. I actually gave out booklets in the Kollel that one of the families, I think it was the Frankel family, sent to me. Big machloket broke out. Because ultimately, these people who chose Lakewood made a very simple statement. With all due respects to Rav Shmuel Feuerl Hirsch, he was, for the times in which he lived, it was not an eternal message. Fighting as he did to keep Torah alive in Germany, all right, Torah Derech Eretz, I don't want to start quoting now from the 19 letters. I can quote endlessly. I don't want to start quoting from Hermann Schwab. But all those quotes that Rakefet has quoted over the decades, that's a bidiyavad. It's l'shaito v'lo yoter. And I don't have to tell you, Rabbi Baruch Berleber, which said this openly in his famous tshuva, and it's been published and republished and translated into many languages, when Reb Shimon Schwab asked him, should I go to college? And he said, Vadai oto tzaddik, he called Rav Hirsch a tzaddik, but it was l'shaito, not l'dorot. And this has been stated publicly in Kehilat Adat Yeshurun itself by some of its rabbinic leadership. That's one part of the community. The other part of the community was too lazy to get on a bus and Port Authority and travel a mile and a half, an hour and a half to Lakewood. They simply walked 10 minutes across Washington Heights and came to Yeshiva University. And in Yeshiva University, they found the closest experience to what they grew up on, Torum Derech Eretz, Torum Mata. I went to school and I didn't know Charlie Hexter. He comes in, he's a little younger than I am. But one of my classmates, Charlie, was Jonas Prager. Don't know if the name means anything to you, Johnny Prager. One of the boys from 100% Medatek in Mitzvos, Kalaka Hamura. But he was at YU and he became an economics professor. We still maintain contact until today. He raised wonderful children, he and his wife Helen. But they chose YU. And there were many others who came and chose YU. And what's so bad about YU? The Gemara was on a much higher level than Frankfurt. We had to break our teeth and learn Yiddish, although the Yekkes had it easier because German is not so distant from Yiddish. I had to break my teeth because I'm coming from a Joe DiMaggio background, but pure American. My parents born in America. And Johnny and I, and there were many others, and Manfred Fulda, Sefer Tzadik Levracha, I don't have a better example. Manfred Fulda, who just died this year, he was a giant of Torah, a giant of Yirat Shemayim, a walking embodiment of everything that Rav Shmuel Shuchel Hirsch stated, represented. And he was one of the Talmidim of Hakam of Rav Soloveitchik. Went on to a long teaching career. Students loved him. I met women over the years that had him at Stern College. He was their Rebbe Muvhak with the Chilul Rechimu. And there's a prime example. I still remember his parents had a jewelry store in Washington Heights. I don't know, Charlie, maybe before your time. And they sold crosses. So I remember in the yeshiva, the question was asked, Manfred's parents, everyone knows him today, Meir, the world changed, but I know him as Manfred. Manfred's parents sold crosses. They said yes. They asked the Scheiler in Germany yet. And there's a difference between a crucifix and a cross. A crucifix is a religious symbol, and a cross is like a mugging dovet. It means you're of Catholic origins, Jewish origins, but it's not really a religious symbol. All right, so the Yekkers, Baruch Hashem, in the state of Israel, I'll tell you, it's very fascinating, and people don't give full credit. You have no idea how much of religious Israel was built by the Germans, by the Yekkers. They came in Aliyah, these people who grew up on anti-Zionism. Again, I can't repeat all my lectures now, and I suffer. I mention something, and then I get endless emails, and it's blowing my mind. I walked in this morning, there were 30 emails waiting for me. Have Rachmanis on me, or hire, like the Lubavitch Rebbe, I want to get two good students who know me inside out. The Rebbe didn't answer every letter. I know the people who wrote for him. I know them from the 50, Rabbi Quint, Litvaken. They knew the Rebbe, wrote every answer. There was a Shaila, they'd ask the Rebbe, and within a minute he'd say one word, and they'd write 20 sentences, and he'd sign the letter afterwards. So there's no question that the Yekkers, it was a countdown in America. They had to make decisions. They weren't big enough to build their own institutions. And this is where you wind up with Washington Heights disappearing into the greater Lakewood world. And I got news for you. You go to Teaneck, you go to Englewood, all those communities, that was a fallout from Washington Heights. Part of Muncie was a fallout from Washington Heights. And when I was saying about Israel, let me finish, you have no idea how much they contributed. They grew up on anti-Zionism, and remember Rav Hirsch's famous statement to Rav Kalischer, what you consider a great mitzvah, I consider a great avera. I just sent the source to a Talmud of mine who asked for it. But they grew up, they came to Israel. They translated almost to a man, including the Breuers, Torah im Derech Eretz to Torah im Derech Eretz Eretz Yisrael. I'm quoting Reb Yitzchak Breuer now. Who built the kibbutzim? Shalavim, Chafetz Chaim, can give you endless names. The Rabbanim, when I came in Aliyah, it was a pleasure. You went to Chafetz Chaim, you thought you were back in Frankfurt. But the kibbutzim, no, Chorev Elementary High School. This is a school that was built in the 30s when they were running away from Germany. There is no other school that has such a successful record of Torah im Derech Eretz. And then let's go one step further. Machon Lev, down the hill. Tell me, Professor Lev, where did he come from? Professor Levy. Famous Professor Levy, these were giants. Where did they come from? These are all descendants of the German community, and wow, what they have accomplished here. But it's moved mainstream. It hasn't retained its own identity. When you say as a Litvisha, as a Hasidisha, we still have separate identities, although tomorrow I'll end off with the trying to show you where we blend into one. But this is the story, and there's no question there were sea changes, but the lasting influence was Litvish Chassidish. The German influence dissipated. Some went right, some went what they would call left. Very few remained with the pure formula of Torah Derech Eretz as Rav Hirsch understood it. And it could be in the United States. It's different than Frankfurt, different than Berlin. The whole situation needs a different approach. Never forget the Gemara in Menachah, Taf Chavtet, Chavchet, with the Sheifrat and the Chatzatzrat. And it's right in this week's Pasha, actually, that every kli in the Beit HaMikdash was Ledorot. Moshe could build it and we could use it 100 years later, 200 years later, 300 years later. But the Chatzatzrat, when Moshe Rabbeinu dies, they're buried with him. They're no good for Yehoshua. He has to make his own Chatzatzrat and trumpets. And the reason is very simple. All the Dashanim say it and there's no better pshat. What would the Chatzatzrat? To get the people together. Lahakir leta'eda. To warn them about war, to unite them, to inspire them. Every generation needs a different trumpet. The trumpet that I was growing up with, that I got from Reb Yeruchim Gurelik, from Neuch Bornstein, those trumpets are not good today. Today's generation needs a new trumpet. 100 years from now, 50 years from now, the new mechanchim, the new challenges, we're out of style. All right, Rakefet has made a conscious effort to keep young and know what's going on in the world. I'll agree. But we have to be honest. The new generation has to blow its own trumpet, not our trumpet. We can hand them everything, but the trumpet we can't hand them. They have to develop and manufacture their own. Now, with all this happening, there's a lot more after World War II. And ultimately, it one influences the other. Now, what am I referring to? Once again, I want to come back to that wonderful book, New York's Jewish Jews. And it's by Jenna Weissman Joslett, published 30 years ago already. And as I understood, and we later were able to verify it, she grew up in an Orthodox home, understands, because this book is written from within. She knows what's going on in Lakewood, in YU, in Flatbush, in Ramaz. She's not a stranger looking in, but a citizen looking out. And I just love her volume. She's published other material too, and she's excellent. So I reviewed this book actually when it came out in Jewish Action 30 years ago. Now, at this time too, here it's fascinating, contradictory. You have the greenhorns, the refugees, pouring into America, and the conservative movement has never been stronger. This is their moment. They eclipse everyone. I'll mention the name, Marshall Sklar. Anyone remember the name? He was a famous Jewish sociologist. And he wrote a volume in 1955, Conservative Judaism. It's quoted and re-quoted, and he shows this is the Judaism of America. And as I mentioned to you, it's exactly America. What's America about? America, on one hand, is ethnic plurality. We're proud of our past. On the other hand, it's the great melting pot. We become Americans. And all of you know we're part of this American dream. Jews who have achieved, Italians who have achieved, Irishmen who have achieved. All right, today, Black Lives Matter, but you have to achieve. Absolutely, all lives matter, but you achieve, there's a challenge. Be proud of your ethnic background, but now you're an American. And this is conservative Judaism. By 1950, you have a second generation, a third generation. You have all the GIs returning from World War II, and seeing what happened to the Jews made them more Jewish conscious. They didn't want to go into a Reform temple, but a conservative temple, this was the ultimate dream. a little bit in Hebrew, a little bit in English, ethnic multiplicity, Lashon HaKodesh, Kippah, Talit. But we're Americans, we're part of the modern world, men and women sit together. And mind you, this challenge, the feminist challenge, which is already 120 years old, nothing has changed. This was the greatest boon to the conservative movement. If outside of shul, women can go to high school, women can go to college, women can be lawyers, remember, first Jewish female lawyer. I knew women yet who were well in their 80s, and they boasted they were the first class, get recognition, a lawyer, the right to vote. We take this for granted today. And to come into a shul and sit behind a fence, segregation, what is this? Jim Crow? And the conservative movement was fabulous. We're religious, we observe, but it's America. You don't have to be fanatics. We don't need a machitza. Men and women are equal. And then came, everyone is running to the suburbs. By the way, they're running to the suburbs again. It's fascinating because of what's going on in New York City. It's like the 1950s all over again. We've gone with cycles. Everyone ran to the suburbs. There's more room, more space, more air. You can drive. And then no one could get into the city. It wound up getting into the city became such a challenge. People were moving back to the city. Now they say anyone with money, my wife showed me articles in the New York Times, Maplewood, New Jersey, I should have kept my house there. I don't know how I would have bought a house here. But wow, people, a place goes on sale for $700,000. People bid on it. They finally sell it, $800,000. People are running away from New York today. But at that point in the early 50s, everyone is going to the suburbs. And when they came out with the ruling, the Committee on Jewish Law, that you're allowed to use your car on Shabbos, this became the greatest boon. And she says that willy-nilly, they had to agree, because everyone was driving already. What it did is it took away the guilt feeling. When I was younger, Jack, and I wanted to make the whole world frum, women and men looked me in the eyes and said to me, our rabbi said you're allowed to drive to temple on the Sabbath. And Professor Joslet cites a statistic that speaks to us. The 1938 graduating class of Yeshiva College, 20% of the graduates went on to the Jewish Theological Seminary and became conservative rabbis. She quotes a Rabbi Rotenberg. He later becomes the president of the conservative rabbinate. And he says, we had to. That's where the future was. Everything was moving conservative. The youth, the GIs, suburbia, anyone who wanted to be a rabbi, that was the future. Max Rotenberg. I don't recall if I ever met him, but I recall vividly reading articles of his, sermons, and he was a bit of a Talmud Chacham. He was a Yeshiva College graduate, like so many others, and they all moved to the seminary. By the mid-60s, I don't think you find one Yeshiva College graduate. By the mid-60s. I know in the early 60s there were just a few. One of them, he's no longer alive, I don't want to mention his name, although it's nothing negative. I taught his four children, three of the four are totally from, totally Orthodox. One is a Tzaddik Yesod Olam in Yerushalayim. I'm proud to say he's been my Talmud many times over. But they all ran away, the conservative movement. By the mid-60s already, the swing to the right has hit home. And you're not going to find the Yeshiva College graduate going to JTS. And many of these people who ran away in the 20s, the 30s, into the 40s, 50s. They claimed, no, we're still Orthodox, but this is the way to go, this is the way to influence. And some did remain Shomrei Torah Mitzvot in their personal life. And some ultimately became very good conservative rabbis. You don't need a better example than Jacob Agus, Talmud Muvhak of Rabbi Revel and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik and the Meshe Te'ilui. And I shouldn't say Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, he already was out of the yeshiva and Reb Moshe came, but he later goes on to be a Reconstructionist rabbi, Talmud Chacham. What a beautiful family, the Akushevitz family. But this was the reality. Now, while this is happening in the early 40s, what we call Yeshiva University today, it wasn't yet Yeshiva University to 1945, is going through a tremendous crisis. When Rabbi Revel dies, and Rabbi Revel was in ill health, December 2nd, January 31st, I think it was, a month and a half later, 41, Revel is 40, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik dies very suddenly. And Shulamit Meiselman, his daughter, writes in her memoir that she believes Reb Moshe died from the Atmos Nefesh, that when they mentioned Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, that he should succeed Rabbi Revel, president of Yeshiva, there was so much opposition to his son, whom he considered a gon, a tzaddik, my Rebbe, but not yet the Rav, Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitchik of Boston, that this opposition affected Reb Moshe's health and ultimately took his life. Ad kedei kach. And this is a very important point, because we're going to come back to it, if not later today, next week. It influences the Rav's life and a good amount of American Torah history. And when Reb Moshe dies, the Agudat HaRabbanan jumps on the yeshiva, K'motzei Shalom Rav. Now we can take over the yeshiva. Now we can straighten out the yeshiva. Now we can turn the yeshiva into an institution we can be proud of. And you have to remember, for the Agudas Rabbanim, as we've stated the last years, yeshiva was a hard pill for them to swallow. These Rabbanim came from Europe, them Gelernt in Volozhin, in Mir, in Slabodka, in Telz, in Vraden, in Brisk. I mentioned so many names now. Was there one place that had a college? A high school mela there was in Telz, and even that they were not happy with. But a college? And I write about this in Revel. I have an entire chapter on this. And this was really troubling them. A college, liberal arts, a Darwin, so much being taught, art, nude bodies, etc. It's not lafi ruchenu, not lafi ruach hayahadut. It's not what we understand Torah should be. And they fought a bit of battle. They wanted to take over the yeshiva. They wanted to appoint the successor. They were very much in favor of the Rav succeeding Rabbi Revel. Fought a bitter, bitter battle. But yeshiva had people like Rabbi Young, like Rabbi Lookstein. These people, chairman of the board, Sam Levy, these people refused to give up control of the yeshiva. Yeshiva is independent. And finally, by 43, after a good 2.5 years of controversy and politics and rumors and fake news, let me use a contemporary word, although it's a bit of anachronism, and I apologize to Ali Weinstein, because I said yesterday it was an anachronistic egg, so I'm also laying an anachronistic egg now. There's no question that Yeshiva made a very, very wise choice. And that was Reb Shmuel Belkin. 2.5 years, Lashon Hara, Rechila, fake news. It's not the way an institution can thrive. In picking Reb Shmuel Belkin, a lot of people were involved in the choice, and I spoke with them, I knew all of them, and they used to say, Chazal chose Reb Shmuel Belkin. Chazal, Chorgin, Tzar, Luchstein. Three dominant figures on the greater yeshiva scene. Professor Pinchas Chorgin of Teachers Institute, Dean Tzar, Shmuel Leib Tzar, who was second in command to Rabbi Revel, a Telsa student of before World War I, very bright, very capable, very knowledgeable, with his fingers on the American rabbinate, the American scene. And of course, I mentioned Rabbi Joseph Luchstein, it needs no introduction. Or Rabbi Luchstein, Little Joe, the man with the mouth that issued pearls. His mouth, Margoliot, came out of his mouth. They chose Rabbi Revel. Why did they choose, not Rabbi Revel, correct me. They chose, Yoma, why didn't you correct me? They chose Rabbi Belkin. Why did they choose Rabbi Belkin? So Dean Tzar, Rabbi Joe Lichtenstein said to me, we all chose Rabbi Belkin because we felt, who was he? All right, he was a gong, he was a genius, he had a PhD from Brown, he was published with Harvard. Yeah, but we could control him. Who was he? What did he know? He could barely speak an audible English, and I gotta tell you the truth, I have tapes of Reb Shmuel Belkin in Yiddish. It also was garbled, his Yiddish, his English. This was not the Rav. And Reb Shmuel Belkin turned out to be the strongest person you could imagine. You could not cross him. And very slowly, he established himself. YU is Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin. Rabbi Belkin is YU. Dean Tzar said to me, I'm quoting this, if anyone's going to write the history of yeshiva, please, this is a quote, with these ears I heard it, they were younger, but the same ears. He said to me, Arnold, you should know, the more titles that Dr. Belkin gave me, the less influence I had in the yeshiva. He was very insightful. He accepted it. Chorgin saw he's a nobody. He ran away to Bar Ilan, the first president, the founding president of Bar Ilan. Rabbi Lichtenstein I'll go into, but privately, I don't want to. He was quite caustic. And because Rabbi Belkin was so strong, he was able to keep the Agudas Harabonim at arm's length. You see, Rabbi Revel grew up in the Agudas Harabonim. Who welcomed him to America? Dov Leventhal, Rabbi Bernard Leventhal, Rabbi Dov Aryeh HaKohen Leventhal welcomed him to America. Who were his friends? They were the Rabbanim in America, Rabbi Lezer Silver, Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg, etc. Rabbi Belkin, who came with a similar background, Litvishayilui, he was a youngster when he came to America, but he already was independent. He wound up in Brown University. He became very friendly with the Reform Rabbi of Providence, Rhode Island. It's a legendary friendship which had some impact on at least local Torah history. And he was able to guide the yeshiva and ultimately, and by the way, everything I'm talking about you will find in Vic Geller's memoir. It's a beautiful memoir, Orthodoxy Reawakens, the Year of Reb Shmuel Belkin. And it's a memoir. There's a difference between a memoir and pure scholarship, but you will find all the facts that I'm citing in that beautiful memoir. Above all, what Rav Shmuel Belkin accomplished was his relationship with the Rav. And here, I've said it many times, I say it again, the world should never forget. It's because of Rav Shmuel Belkin that the Rav became the Rav. And it's crucial to understand this. Joey, you knew the Rav in Boston in the 1930s. The Rav went through hell. In the early 40s, the Kashrut, the state investigation, I can tell you, Tova Lichtenstein once told me, Dr. Tovid said, that my father would come home from the investigation and being questioned, and there'd be the other side claiming he made money under the table. He would come home shattered that people could lie so brazenly. And the truth is, the Rav was Bar Mai Matnafish. And you all know, I write about it in 44, 45, Chicago turned to the Rav. We made a bad mistake in 32. Mark, if you can tell them this in Chicago over Shabbos, we made a bad mistake telling you, go fly a kite, we have no money to bring you to Chicago. We brought you to America, but that's it. Go find a position on the East Coast. We can't make you Rosh Yeshiva of what you call today Skokie. And they wanted him to come to Chicago. And the Rav was within like 90% decided. I had enough of Boston, I had enough of aggravation, enough of the Kashra scandals. YU was really a nothing at the time. I'll go to Chicago. And it was Dr. Belkin and some of the Balabatim in Chicago, including Joey Abelow's parents and other friends of the family, that prevailed upon the Rav remain in Boston. But when Rabbi Belkin takes over the yeshiva, 44, and he says to the Rav, Beryl, I'm responsible for the finances. You're responsible to the students. With that, it was the greatest gift we got. Because the Rav could be totally in the classroom, Dvar Hashem Zu Halacha, and he became the Rav. He became the Rav. You got to remember that the Yeshiva University at that time, it attracted the finest minds. There was no yeshiva that equaled it. With all due respects to Torah Vedas, Rav Shlomo Hyman dies in 45, at that moment, there's no one but no one that comes near the Rav. And I know people who left Torah Vedas to learn with the Rav, to learn with Reb Moshe, Reb Yosef Weiss is an example. But the Rav was the Rav now. And when you have bright students, I once quoted Barry Lieberman. Barry Lieberman, Barnett Lieberman, got smicha a few years before me. Very close friends until today. I taught his daughters, and we know each other from high school yet. So Barry once said, when he looked at a picture, the picture I published of my class in 1960, he said, what was it like for the Rav to face so many brilliant individuals? And you got to remember, this is a challenge. I don't know let me just talk about myself. I don't know what if I would have become had I gone to teach in Hebrew U, Bar Ilan. I would have been a nobody, a nothing. Where's the challenge? The Kollel, over the years, the Talmidim I picked up, I've taught Gedolei Yisrael. But you got to rise to the challenge. The Rav became the Rav. And it's very important to understand this, as we will see. Now, With all this happening, there's another side to the story. Yes, the refugees are taking over America, influencing America. And this is happening all over. including why you. And in Professor Joslett's doctorate, I believe this is, she quotes our friend George Kranzler, ultimately Baltimore, Talmudical Academy, am I correct this time, Morty? TA in Baltimore. George Kranzler, very keen, insightful individual. And he says, years ago, the students at at what we call YU today, they looked down at the Agudas HaRabbanim Dov, they would say, who are these people? What are they, Europeans? They never went to college. What do they know? We're American rabbis. All right, so we haven't finished Shas yet. We'll get there. But we know we can respond. We're insightful. And now, who are the students talking about? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein? Rabbi Aaron Kotler? Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky? The Lubavitcher Rebbe? The Satmaruv, the Bluzheva Rebbe, the Bubava Rebbe, the Square Rebbe, all this popped up in YU. Oh boy, I want to see one student talk down about Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Derech Eretz we held for Rav Moshe. I remember when Rav Moshe would come to Washington Heights for Shabbos to be with his daughter Shifra Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha. I knew Shifra, Isha Gedolah, Moshe David Tendler should live and be well, his wife, spend the Shabbos with them. You don't know what went on Sunday. Everyone was asking questions. Who ate with Reb Moshe? Who was at Rabbi Tendler's house? What did Reb Moshe do here? What did Reb Moshe do here? What did he paskin here? Our ears were like this. Rabbi Aaron Kotler, Divi Hartman came to YU. I went to Lakewood because of Divi Hartman. I have to be honest with you. Spoke Rabbi Aaron, Slutsk, Kletz, Europe, Rabbi Zalman. Oh boy. Professor Joslett hits the nail on the head. You couldn't dismiss these people. So you see, even at YU already, they're shifting gears. It's a fascinating picture where we're at after World War II. And here, she quotes Rabbi Riskin, and Rabbi Riskin quoting Rabbi Luchstein. Part of the quote, you'll pardon me, I'm not going to repeat. The language is a little bit, I don't know how it's being used in scholarship, but maybe there's a heta to reproduce what rabbis say word by word, but it's not in my vocabulary. But Rabbi Riskin says, we started laughing at Rabbi Luchstein, Rabbi Goldstein, they're teaching homiletics. These aren't real courses. These don't count. The world, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe, and Rabbi Luchstein tells him, and evidently by this time already, Rabbi Riskin is teaching in the Jewish Studies program, he says, don't worry, he says to Rabbi Riskin, it's a passing facade. This glory for these great European Rabbanim, it will not last. And I need not tell you that Rabbi Luchstein was totally incorrect. You'll see, he remarked, cautioning a younger colleague, the younger colleague in a footnote is Steve Riskin, about the excesses of the right wing. This is a passing fad. So all this is happening right under our eyes. World War II, post Yeshiva University, conservative Judaism, right wing, what's evolving into Yeshiva University now, 45, they get university status, the student body, the influence of the Gedolei Yisrael who have come to America. I want to tell you in parentheses, apropos of Rabbi Lichtstein, at least I'm in good company. Over the 52 years we have lived in Israel, so I've been teaching, and many times students think a Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh, and they ask me all types of questions. If you listen to the recordings over the last, since I think the recordings are from early 90s now, you'll find I comment on every contemporary situation. I only was wrong once. Every other comment, wow, kol hakavod, man has insight. Once, totally, absolutely wrong. Anyone know what I'm talking about? When Shas started up, so they challenged me in BMT, a lot of Sfati kids already, what's going to be with Shas? And some of these kids were ashamed of Shas because it was too frum for them. So I said to them, it's a passing fancy. I can't believe that this ethnic hatred will continue. And I have to tell you, it's 30, almost 40 years later, and boy, Shas is more powerful than it's ever been, and Rakefet's a bigger dope than he ever was. So Baruch Hashem, I apologize for my stupidity, but I'm in good company, Rabbi Lichtstein and I both said. Have no fear, it won't last. And you should know, this was thrown up in my face. One of the people in the class at that time in BMT, suddenly the OU was lionizing me, and he meets me in the OU office and says to me, but I want you to know, Rebbe, what you said, how wrong you are. And boy, I couldn't escape. He caught me black and white. Okay. Bruch ato Adonai lechem melech olam she'kol nieh b'dvaro. Let me come to the masterpiece. They just celebrated 25 years since publication and tradition. Did a whole special issue. And here's my classmate Chaim Soloveitchik. Now I have to tell you, Chaim I know very well, and genius, no two ways about it. I don't know if there was another Talmud Chacham raised in America who has the knowledge of Shas and Paiskim that Chaim has. In addition, he broadened, went into Chachmat Yisrael, and there's a lot more than just Shas and Paiskim to Chaim. If you see his work, his magnum opus on Stam Yenam, it's the golden letter in Chachmat Yisrael. You have to be both a Talmud Chacham, and you have to be attuned to what Wissenschaft der Studentip is about to appreciate Chaim's scholarship. He had three teachers in life. First of all, his father, Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, the Rav. Secondly, Professor Shaul Lieberman. And thirdly, Professor Yaakov Katz. I need not tell you that all three of these individuals were goyim shebegoyim. Professor Yaakov Katz, I used to daven with every Shabbos till the day he died. He lived on Chaim, Herbie Maltz. He lived where you live, exactly where you live, on Palmach, in one of the houses, I think, behind you, because your building didn't exist at the time. He used to daven at Ol Rivka. He was rector of Hebrew University, a little man, maybe 5'4", 5'5", skinny as could be. And he got up and gave Birchat Kahanim. It was a pleasure to listen to him. He knew Kala Torah Kula and tremendous Chochmat Yisrael. What an individual. And those three people had a tremendous influence on my classmate, Reb Chaim. Of all of Chaim's publications, nothing has gained the same fame and as wide an audience, and as so widely cited as his classic article in Tradition, 1994, Rupture and Reconstruction, the Transformation of Contemporary Orthodoxy. I have to tell you, this article, first of all, it's brilliant, it's genius. I don't say it's the Rav, I don't say it's from Shaul Lieberman, but you certainly see Professor Jacob Katz there. Professor Jacob Katz, with all his knowledge, and he was a graduate of Hildesheim, with a Goynisha memory, with all his knowledge, he also became a sociologist. Some of his later volumes dealing with Torah in the modern world, you see a great deal of sociology. In this piece, you see Chaim, Talmud Chacham, Chochmat Yisrael, but no, an unbelievable keen observer, a sociologist par excellence. In addition, it's very revealing, and you have to give credit to the Rav, and his, I guess more than the Rav, his wife, Rebbetzin Tanya. Chaim is the Rav's son. Not easy to be the Rav's son. Would you imagine you wake up every morning and people look at you, an anical from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Briska, the expectations. But what's beautiful about this article is you get the feeling Chaim was allowed to grow up normally. He grew up in Boston, he grew up in Maimonides, he grew up a normal street kid in that area. He knew what was going on. And I just want to quote the first part of the article. What's interesting about it, I'll show you that, again, 25 years later, you have to ask yourself, and in Tradition, there was a lot of backwards and forwards, what is still valid, what is not valid today. But I got to tell you, in 1994, this article was a photograph. That would be the proper term to use, of where Orthodoxy stood after the Holocaust. And you all know Chaim's rupture and reconstruction. What does it mean, rupture? That everyone went to America, everyone disappeared as Jews, nothing was left, and then reconstruction came after World War II. Now, I want to make one comment on this. A lot of people, right after the article appeared, Professor Mark Steiner, who I mourn for, was my, of all the people I know who died due to corona, no one was closer to me than Mark Steiner. Mark and Richie, the two famous professors, the two geniuses, their mother and my mother were in kindergarten together. So our relationship goes back to, I would say, 1915, 1916. And Mark came to me right after this article appeared. Arnie, you got to write a response to Chaim. Look at my parents. Look at my aunt and uncle. That also, I would call them aunt and uncle, the Horowitzes. These people remain from. Yes, whenever you do sociology, there's no such thing that there was 100% rupture. Certainly people remain from. But 90-95% Chaim is 100% right. There was a total rupture. I got an email, one of the students listening to our classes now, himself, well known in his field, I imagine retired today, age. So Pesach writes that his own family, they came from the Midwest of the United States, North Dakota, and his grandparents wound up there because they got free land. It probably had to do with the Baron Hirsch resettlement. And could you imagine having roots from North Dakota more than well over 100 years ago, and they remained from? All right, this is the, I would use the word, this is the exception that proves the rule. So I'm going to go along with Reb Chaim, Professor Chaim, and say, yes, rupture. And then they came in, and The author, and I love Chaim, he's right down to earth here. The orthodox in which I and many other people my age, and Chaim and I are, by the way, exactly the same age. We're a few weeks apart. Chaim was born in Sukkot, I was born in Hanukkah. We're raised scarcely exists anymore. The change is often described as the swing to the right. In one sense, this is an accurate description. Many practices, especially the new rigor in religious observance now current among the younger modern Orthodox community, did indeed originate is what is called the right. And Chaim has a very brilliant analysis here, what separates modern Orthodoxy from the so-called right. And by the way, this analysis we live with in Israel, it goes on until today. It's constantly being challenged, constantly being developed further. But we grew up in a world when we were kids, modern Orthodoxy, everyone went to college. No one questioned college. Teva Vedas, Chaim Berlin, RJJ, wherever you were, you went to college. All right, not everyone went to Harvard or Yale. You went to City College, but you went to college. When we grew up, everyone was a Zionist. Who heard of not being a Zionist? Everyone was overwhelmed as a state of Israel. After what Hitler did to us, the UN voted partition. I've told you many times, my teachers in Salanta were standing in the hallway and crying, literally crying, grown people crying. A kid, for me, that was, all right, I never knew how much I would cry later in life, but if you're a Jew, at times, you have to cry. And who ever dreamt anti-Zionism? Along comes the Reconstruction, Rav Aaron Cutler, the Satmaruv, Lubavitch, all that goes with it, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Akurit Yisrael. All right. Now comes to Zionism. Not everyone is a Zionist. Not everyone is celebrating Yom HaTzmaut. And you talk about secular studies. Who would ever dream that you'd hear in America Rav Aaron Cutler, Devar Hashem Bazar, quoting the Gemara in Chelek, Sanhedrin, anyone who goes to college is, lo aleinu, reprimanding, rebuking the Word of God, negating the Word of God. And he says, when I grew up, these were the big differences. It's very interesting. This is Chaim growing up in Boston, like hitting the nail on the head. All right? He says today, the differences are still there, but not as great. The kids go to college in the modern Orthodox world, but not with the same enthusiasm. I always use the example of Chinese literature. Could you imagine someone went to the Rebbe and said, Rebbe, I'm interested in Chinese literature. I'd like to do postgraduate work and a doctorate. The Rebbe would have said to him, oh, very interesting. Let me know if you find any similarities to Chazal, ancient wisdom. Today, if you went to one of the Rebbe's descendants who are your Rebbeim, and you said, you know, I'd like to do a doctorate in Chinese literature, they say, you better think twice. Chinese literature, it's a waste of time. It's so difficult. You'll have to put in so much effort. What will you do with Shas and Paiskim? You can't do something. Take something. All right, you want to make panasi, you want to make a living. Take mathematics, something easier. You'll get your doctorate. You'll have panasa. And Chaim is absolutely right here. And then... you talk about Zionism. Well, even the Haredi world over the years, you notice that they have opened up a lot more to the state of Israel. Their boys, their girls, everyone is coming to study. Who fought the battle to get the students here this year? So to a certain degree, there are shifts in where we stand. And by the way, in the state of Israel, these questions are very, very real. Because as the Haredim multiply and increase and have more self-confidence and want to move more mainstream, so you notice you already have Haredim celebrating Yom HaTzmut. What's the matter? We have a lot to be proud of. This is our country. We're part of it. We're building it. And today with secular study, every university, and right now this is before the Supreme Court, God have mercy if they rule, as I'm afraid they will, that you can't have separate courses for men and women. This is totally against democracy. Everyone has a right to their own thinking when it comes to the sexes mingling. And the truth of the matter is that every survey in the world has shown where you have boys and girls separate from seventh grade on, their academic achievements are infinitely better than when you have every class a social scene. And you have no right to force your lifestyle upon Haredim. I grew up graduate school, mixed, never bothered me. But I can understand Haredim. They never sat in a classroom, men and women together. So the universities are accommodating them. And this now is being challenged. And among the challenges are the Torah, the Avoda movement of the religious Zionist world, that this is a disgrace for women, that they have to have separate classes from men. Now, my mind doesn't tolerate it, doesn't understand it. Democracy is democracy, freedom of choice. Everyone can choose his own lifestyle in conformity with the Dvar Hashem, Zu Halacha. But it's interesting that these changes and what Rav Chaim talks about are as real today, as questionable today, as challenging today, as they were 25 years ago, 50 years ago. It's not that life hasn't changed. Life certainly has changed, but we move on. Every generation will seek its own answer. I always use the example, and I guess Lubavitchers will be upset with me, look at Shlomo LeKalbach. Shlomo LeKalbach had to leave Chabad because the Rebbe refused to give him permission to run outreach for boys and girls together. This is the 50s, and Schleimler said, if I don't have boys and girls together, I'll get one or two men will come, no one else. And those who come, there's something the matter with them. Why are they coming if there are no girls there? Today, show me one Chabad outreach which doesn't have men and women together. Look at the outreach Rosh Yehudi in Tel Aviv today. It's all men and women together. You can't do one without the other. They make shidduchim, etc. So these are ongoing topics. But Chaim says what really has affected everyone, what had been a stringency peculiar to the right in 1960, a Lakewood Chumrah, a B'nai Brak Chumrah. And today in the 1990s, it is widespread practice in modern Orthodox circles and among the younger members, an axiomatic one. I'll comment in a minute. And the time gap, this is Chaim, between developments in the Haredi world and the emerging modern Orthodox world, some 15 years at most. And what Reb Chaim says here, very fascinating. You take a chumrah, at one time you dismissed it. Stop an Abrach, Lakewood. Today that chumrah is all over the place. And Chaim uses an example, and we're going to come back to this in the Sunday class. And I've yelled and shouted about this, and I understand Chaim 1,000%. You take the Seder. People give out mats. How much masa do you have to have? Place it on the mat. How much lettuce do you have to have? Place it on the mat. Ribbono shel Olam, what are you doing? You a seder, you know what your parents did, you know what your grandparents did, you know what every Jew does. You have to put it on a mat, you have to measure it, you have to see that the matzah fills half the mat, half the napkin. Jack, what are you showing me? That's to measure, what is that to measure? I can't see clearly. But Jack is showing me like you attach the matzah to it, and you measure, and I Ribbono shel Olam with a cup of wine, whatever. And this began as a chumrah. Today, you will find in many YU houses, the kids sit down to the Seder with the mat there, measuring the matzah, measuring the marah. And I don't know. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasharet. The Aruch HaShulchan says, if you're going to take a right angle measure, no one's tefillin will be kasha. You all know that the bottom have to be merubaatz, but if you measure it, it's going to be slightly off. But that doesn't lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasharet. And you want to see that Chaim is right, I'll tell it to you very simply. My middle daughter got involved with art. My wife is an artist, and some of my children have inherited, some of my grandchildren. I have two grandchildren, graduates of Bezalel, so not many people can boast that they have two from grandchildren who graduated Bezalel. So we had to get my daughter a light table. She works on ketuvot, and you need a light table to trace. And lo and behold, Haredim started coming into our house on Thursday using the light table to check the lettuce. And I told my daughter, halacha lemaisa, this goes against the whole spirit of Torah Hashem. The Kohanim had to walk to the lockers when they finished the avoda. They didn't strip naked in front of everyone. They had to walk and change their clothes. And it's not hanar from clothes. It's just, this is the human reality. You can't strip naked in public. You have to go to the locker and get rid of the big day kahuna there. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasharet. And lo and behold, nowadays, Rabbi Grunstein sent this to me, something with an OU heksha. When we use vegetables, especially the leafy ones, we ensure that they are thoroughly cleaned for microscopic insects. There is high quality control wherein they are put under a light box to check for bugs. It says under a light box, but Yomo says it's wrong. It should be put over a light box. You're right, Yomo. It's not under. It's over. But I don't know. This man, I can't believe this is real. Maybe this is a joke. But if it is real, boy, is Chaim Soloveitchik right. 15 years later, was es ungefunden as a gewaffene Chumre in Bnei Brak or a Lakewood, jetzt for Alamin. The Chumre is for everyone. It's not isolated only to the Haredi world. So Chaim makes some golden points in that article. And this is World War II. We can't deny it. Anyone who grew up in YU, I remember in my time, by the way, if we drink water, when's you going to go with microscopic bugs? How do you drink water? Take an electron microscope and you think you're looking at you're in an aquarium.
Microscopic is also a misstatement. Is microscopic being very small that it can still be seen with naked eye?
Yoma right away is being malamed schut on the chumra. That microscopic means you can see with the naked eye. Yoma.
I know what they're talking about. I was working for OU.
Yomo was a mashkich for you. He knows what he's doing. So I'm zayn gesund. Okay, fine. Have it either way, but I eat lettuce even if it wasn't checked on a light table. As long as it's here in Israel, you don't have a problem. You have kush katif, and you wash it off, and kanayin hara, it's a pleasure, mamish a pleasure.
And it must be checked. It says on the picture, it must be checked.
I can tell you in YU, When I learned in Lakewood, let's go back to Lakewood. When I learned in Lakewood, we davened with a hat, Atifat Rosh. You had 50 guys davening, you had 50 different types of hats. Baseball hats, golf hats, felt hats, straw hats. No one, but no one, wore a black hat. Only the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Aaron Kotel, wore a black hat. Even the Mashgiach, Rabbi Nosson Wachtvogel, the Alte Mashgiach, didn't wear a black hat, brown hat. There are pictures of him I can show. It's a fact. Later, today you're going to Lakewood. Everyone. I once was driving home from Gruss, and from Hebron Yeshiva, they were walking. There was some Levaya in the center of the city. I forget who it was. And they were walking right where I was driving to get to Rechavia. And outside of the difference in height, I couldn't tell anyone apart. When I looked at them from the back, all I saw was a black suit, a black hat. Going to Lakewood today, how you put your hats on a hat rack and they can tell them apart. They must put stickers on each hat with a number. Each one has to claim his number because the dress is exactly alike. Why you? I can tell you in the 1990s in the Kollel, I don't believe there was a student here who didn't wear a black hat. Today, whatever the reasons are, I think it has to do with the rebellion of Avi Weiss and what happened with Chovevei Torah and why you started to rethink itself. So the black hat is not totally dominant anymore. But Reb Chaim hits the nail on the head. Okay, let me go a drop further. With all this happening, and this is life, nothing stands still in life. My father, Zichrono Livracha, and I don't have a father already, 40 years. My father, standing on my terrace in Yerushalayim, surrounded myself, my wife, my daughters. My father used to say, if only time could stand still. But that's the human destiny. Time does not stand still, Sefer Kohelet. We move on. And after World War II, all these forces are at work, to a certain degree, interlocking, to a certain degree, tension. But you have a modern orthodoxy that has finally achieved the ability to thrive on the American scene. You have a powerful conservative movement that is at its zenith. No one would ever dream what would be to the conservative movement 50 years later. If you would have said to Marshall Sklar, there's going to come a time when the New York Times is going to write that the only future for American Jews is Orthodox and Hasidic, Marshall Sklar said, impossible. He wouldn't believe it. That time has come. But you have conservative, you have the refugees, you have what is happening on the ground. And all this interlocks, interconnects. And let me go a drop further. And I'm now going back to Louis Bernstein, challenge and mission. Right after World War II, with the problems of the conservative movement, RCA made a very sincere step. Let's combine our forces. They tried to get a working relationship with the Agudas HaRabbanim. Drake tried to have a total merger with the Igud HaRabbanim, the Rabbinical Alliance. They wanted to stand united, the conservative movement. You have the problem of the ketuvah, the conservative Beit Din. There's going to be a big mechitza problem. Why can't we stand united? And here you have those that were in favor and those that are opposed. Take the Agudas HaRabbanim, you take Reb Lezer Silva. Reb Lezer Silva of Cincinnati, his own children went to Yeshiva University. His own son, Reb David Lev Silva, prominent graduate musmach of the yeshiva, rabbi of Harrisburg all his life, Reb Lezer Silva was 100% joint forces, unite. If we have a problem with the young rabbis, they're not learned enough, introduce under the Agudas HaRabbanim a more intensive learning program at Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan. Reb Lezer, totally in favor. But here you see the influence of the Reconstruction. A name comes on the scene and he plays a very dominant role in the Agudas HaRabbanim. A name which maybe some of you may or may not recognize. Reb Simcha Elberg. Give you his years. I want to say a few words about him. How many of you recognize the name Reb Simcha Elberg, first of all? Anybody? All right, a few people do. Baruch Hashem. Rabbi Simcha Elberg, 1915-1995. Born in Poland, grew up in Poland. Studied with the giants of Warsaw, a musmach of Reb Menachem Zemba. When you mention the name Reb Menachem Zemba, you have to stand Yirat HaKavod. I apologize to his memory, but I'm a little too old, but at least let me stand. Giant of giant dies in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Reb Simcha Elberg studies Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, winds up running away via Shanghai, miraculously saved because he followed the Mir Yeshiva, reaches America in 1947. Here is a Jew, marries in America, they never have children. His nephew, who was my student, he was very close to his brother-in-law, his family, his wife's sister, married to Rabbi Weinberger, was a Rav of upstate New York, beyond New York City, and very close to the family. And Reb Simcha Elberg, right wing, 100%, very fascinating individual, brilliant Talmud Chacham, published Svarim, bought Hapades, and Hapades was a private rabbinical publication of Shmuel David Halevi Pades, sold it to Rabbi Elberg, and he published it to the end of his life. It supported him, because Hapades, you got advertisements from... The whole gelatin controversy was played out in Hapades. The whole controversy about casing for salamis, hot dogs, was played out in Hapades. Endless advertisements, people paid to get publicity in. So that was his panasa, lived in Brooklyn, Borough Park, I believe. And it was fascinating. On one hand, he was a great admirer of Rav Soloveitchik. He knew who the Rav was, and he knew the Rav's godless, and if you open up Rakefet's work on, I believe it was Nesuva Era, I write about Rav Aaron Cutler's funeral, and how they wouldn't let the Rav speak, and Rav Elberg, in an editorial, called them to order. On the same hand, this Rabbi Elberg was 100% against rabbinical council. And he had reasons why. And at this moment in time, we're talking the 50s, the 60s, and we're going to see this next week, you had members of rabbinical council, rabbis in shuls where there was mixed seating, rabbis in shuls where there was separate seating but no mechitza, rabbis in shuls where there was a microphone being used on Shabbos. And I know that Ellie Weinstein will not believe it, but Baltimore, just go to Baltimore. I met a young man who came to thank me yesterday for some help I gave to him in Saliyah. He just settled in Ramat Beit Shemesh from Baltimore. They won't believe it today. Baltimore, the psak in the city was, you can use a microphone turned on by a guy on Shabbos. Reb Simcha Levi's psak. We spoke about it. And Rav Elberg was furious. RCA? These are rabbis? These are people I can sit with? These are people who I can form joint committees with? Shuls without mechitzas? Shuls with microphones? And I'll tell you, more than that, I knew Rabbi Elberg was a kanoi. But let me tell you a little personal story. Going in Aliyah is a very traumatic experience. So I remember everything that happened the days before we went on the boat, what happened on the boat when the boat arrived in Israel. After the initial trauma, the last 52 years blend into one saga. So I remember the last book I bought in America with Tales of Hasidim by Jerome Mintz. I quoted it when I gave lectures on Chabad, lectures on Hasidus. That was the last book I bought. But right before I sailed, Rabbi Elberg came out with a new book, and he was very pleased with his nephew who had been in my shiur that year, and he wanted the nephew to give me a gift and a signed copy of the book. The book is a memoir, Vasha Shelmala, a beautiful memoir published in B'nai Brak, The Heavenly Warsaw. And it's inscribed to me, and I have to be honest, I put the book aside, and I didn't read it until about a year ago. A year ago, I got to the book. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed the volume. It is magnificent. Halavai I could write Hebrew on one half the level that Reb Simcha Elberg wrote Hebrew. Modern Hebrew. Fabulous, fabulous. He explains the difference between the Litvisher approach to learning, the Hasidisher approach to learning. He explains the uniqueness of Warsaw, of Polish Jewry, of Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin. I loved the book. And then I reached the very end. And I am shattered. I am shell-shocked. I'm on the floor. I have to be revived. At the end of the book, he deals with the Shoah. And he blames the Zionists 100% for causing the Holocaust. And wow, you gotta read it to believe it. I mean, I heard this before from the Satma, but here is Reb Simcha Elberg, a man who admired the Rav, a man who knows what's going on. And we demonstrated against Hitler. We didn't use Shtatlanut. We were Mishaset HaKelev. What we did, what we fought, this was the most terrible mistake of all. And this is what brought the Holocaust about. And he goes on and on in three pages, totally against. He says, anyone who tells you Reb Menachem Zember gave permission for the revolution, the rebellion, fighting in the Warsaw Ghetto, what broke out in Chol HaMoed Pesach 43, Impossible. Jews don't fight. Jews don't lift a hand against Goyim. I couldn't believe my eyes. But now you get to see Reb Simcha Elberg. So any time, and Louis Bernstein cries about this, but now I understand it. Any time you suggested RCA cooperate, Agudas HaRabbanim, come out against the conservative ketuvah together, unity is strength. Reb Simcha Elberg, who now controls Agudas HaRabbanim, he is Yoshev Rosh Vat HaPoel. He's the man who's there in the office every day. It's Gedolei Yisrael, presidents, but he's the man on the ground. He's running the show. RCA, 100% treif. Let them get rid of all the rabbis that have mixed pews, all the rabbis that have microphones. Then we will talk together. Until then, we have little in common. Zelichud v'zelichud. This is Reb Simcha Elberg. RCA fell flat in its face. Time and again, hold the joint conference. Speak out together. Criticize the conservative ketuvah. Criticize what's happening in the conservative temples. Refused to join. RCA had to remain with OU, a voice that spoke on its own. And when you look at Jewish action in the 50s, you will, not Jewish action, its predecessor, I'm sorry, Jewish action didn't exist yet, Jewish life in the 50s into the 60s, you will not find basically one issue where there isn't an article against the conservative movement. An article against how they were taking over synagogues, how they were pandering to the masses, how they were saying, take down the mechitza, we'll give you rabbis who condone it, who encourage it, who understand the greatness of women and the era in which we are living. But Agudas HaRabbanim, it's a different world. RCA had to fight this battle entirely on its own. We'll pick up next week exactly where we're leaving off. Rabbinical Alliance, and you'll see there too the influence of what Reb Chaim calls the rupture, but the reconstruction. That even there, their hands are tied by what's happening in America. And then we come in to one of the high points of the year, Mount Clemens and New Orleans. One second there. Cleaning the floor. Mount Clemens and New Orleans. And then we go in to Mori Rebbe. He comes, and here's where he becomes the Rav. He's on the American scene, full force. He's gotten over the trauma of Boston, of the Kashrut investigation, of the heartache, of the false news, of the lies. And we'll quote some of his writings. And then we're setting the stage for the biggest machloket, which to a certain degree lives on until today, which unites all these forces, conservative, RCA, right-wing, Agudas HaRabbanim, Synagogue Council. All that we've spoken about, we've planted the seeds for the 1956 reconstruction in the full sense of the word. And I will show you there was a bit of a rupture already back in the late 20s. But Dayal Tzara Bishata. So I want to reiterate, first of all, Ani Modela Kadosh Baruch Hu, that I have the strength. At my age, we don't take it for granted. I want to thank Gris Kolil. What they built here, which you can't see, makes it more pleasant to teach because I can see. It's not like yesterday. It was opaque. And this is really a beautiful professional job. And I imagine that tomorrow there might be some students in the room, but I'm protected, we hope, with the fence around me. What did we do today? So we set the seeds. What happened? 1940s, rupture, reconstruction, Rabbi Luxstein, a passing fancy, Rabbi Riskin poking fun at the homiletics courses. I wonder today if you challenge Rabbi Riskin, why did you poke fun? You're the greatest speaker that YU ever produced. Maybe it's due to the fact that you had some good homiletics courses. All right, but when we're younger, we're more apt to poke fun. The influence, Hasidish, Litvish, and I think what I said is very correct. The Yeti world, the German world, voted itself out of existence. It either went to Lakewood or it went to the greater YU world. In Israel, they rediscovered themselves. And we have a lot to be thankful for. We have a lot to be thankful for. Chorev, Mechon Lev, Parv Rilan, the religious kibbutzim. There's no end to what Torah and Derech Eretz have contributed to. But once again, life is not static. The trumpet is different. The Torah Derech Eretz we live today is vastly different than the way Moshe Arend was raised, according from yesterday's shir in Frankfurt am Main. Above all, I want to thank everyone for their participation and joining me today. And the Eibishter should give us all strength. The Sorah Tovat, we should survive. Our leaders, our government, there should be a total lockdown. The death rate is very frightening, and we have to say no. No to demonstrations, and no to Hasidic weddings, and no to mass Arab weddings. Pikuach nefesh is doicha kol haTorah kula, and it's beyond comprehension how our leaders, including religious leaders, so-called Haredim, don't understand this. They should go back to elementary Talmud Torah and learn the basics of Yiddishkeit. Until we meet again in health and happiness, which will be tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, for those that are interested, I trust that Rabbi Bednash sent out a link. Morty, do you know anything about it?
Yeah, I sent out the link to everybody on all your lists.
Thank you very much. Because it's Rabbi Bednash, he's delaying his teaching tomorrow. And they felt there was no... I didn't know Rabbi Steinsaltz intimately, but I certainly knew him. So I guess by default, we're going to come forth tomorrow, and why you should do something in his memory. As I said, they allotted a half hour to me. Halavai, I should finish within the half hour. All right, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya, Mori calls to call today's lecture...
The recording has stopped.
Call today's lecture Reconstruction After World War II. Reconstruction After World War II. And what do? You're sending it on to Ellie Weinstein, and Ellie will put it up on YU.
Well, you tell me who. Where does it go?
Yomo, are you sending it on?
Yeah.
So, Yomo, do you have the titles for the lectures?
No, if everybody writes the titles,
I got to write them out for Yomo. Okay, I'll write them out and we'll do it. Okay, Yomo, hold on to it until you see it's on. Yomo is Yomo Nikavelito. One second, what did we call yesterday's lecture? Rabbi Minhaha, Rabbi Shlomo Minhaha on Yom Tov Sheni. And today's lecture, what did we call it? Reconstruction.
After World War
II. Okay, now open. I have to hurry home because we're having some furniture fix. I have to be able to pay the man. But if there are any questions, open it up.
Okay, I'll unmute everybody. But Yomo, I'm making Rebbe the host. So when you finish, that'll close it down.
Yomo's not here, but I'll tell him.
Okay, whenever you close your computer, you'll be okay.
Right, can. Okay.
And, oops, wait a minute. I have to unmute everybody first. Okay. All right. Okay.
Are there any questions?
You're unmuted. Everybody can talk.
Mark Licht, I don't hear you. You're talking, but... I can't hear.
I said, Rav Simcha Elberg, in addition to everything else, at the old Hechsher on Coca-Cola in the United States.
All right, Baruch Hashem, we needed panasa.
Whether they can tell the Rav Hamacher what's in it. With the OU, they gave them a big list, supposedly.
Right, I know. That goes back to Rabbi Geffen, got the list in the 1920s. So they didn't give... In other words... They gave more ingredients than that which was in it, and they didn't give the percentages. And Baruch Hashem...
Rabbi Rabach for a while, and the OU thing fell apart when they first did it. It went to Rabbi Rabach, and then it went to the OU.
So my student from Atlanta is the one who does the Hashkacha. Okay, so you can eat, you can drink Coca-Cola on Pesach. That much I can tell you. He goes to Ireland where they make the essence, and he's there in February already this year. He thank God he got there and got out, and then the pandemic hit us. Okay.
The regular Coca-Cola is Shemekitniot, but the sucrose one is okay. But for Ochle Kitniot, they can have the regular one apparently. There's a Coca-Cola museum in Atlanta, which has Coke from all different countries. And I was hesitant to drink any of the other ones because you don't know what's in there. Someone said that everything in the museum is okay, but I don't know if it's reliable.
Well, what can I tell you? We're not going to be in the museum tomorrow, so I'm not going to worry about it. But, all right, anyone else? All right, until we meet again in health and happiness, thank you so much. Besorah tova, Yeshut v'nechamata, Leinu v'al kol Yisrael.